At Red Barn, our pet food ingredients work overtime. They aren't just there for show. Dandelion greens work to maintain a healthy digestive system. Salmon oil works to enhance the immune system. Green-lipped mussels work to support joint health. These hard-working ingredients support your dog's active, healthy life. Look at the label. We want you to. Red Barn Naturals Pet Food. Simply the best. Find it in your local pet specialty store. Visit redbarninc.com/coupon to save a dollar off your first can.
Blog Talk Radio.
Hey! What's going on, gang? Welcome back to Underground Wellness Radio, brought to you, of course, by undergroundwellness.com. I am your host, Sean Croxton, as always. We've got another phenomenal show for you guys tonight. I got a brand new favorite book that I just cannot put down. I'm trying to memorize this book, y'all. I was at a family reunion this weekend. I kind of feel like I was being rude because all I did was, like, lay in bed and read this book. Kind of feel like I dissed my family a little bit. My bad, y'all. The book is the bomb. It's called The Vegetarian Myth by Lierre Keith, who is our guest tonight. We're going to drop some bombshells and some information on you guys. You know, it's all about information. I know a lot of vegetarians and vegans out there are going to send me mean emails and whatnot, but, you know, it's not really about that. It's not really a who's right and who's wrong or about a big debate. Like somebody just like an hour ago on Facebook sent me a BBC article saying that vegetarian children have higher IQs than non-vegetarian children. Really, I'm not interested. You know, studies can go either way. That's something that's very debatable. I really want to stick tonight to things that aren't very debatable. I want to understand, and I want Lierre to help us all understand how nature works. You know what I mean? I want to know, you know, how my food grows. I want to know what a plant eats. We tend to not think about what plants eat. I want to know where my food comes from. How many miles did it have to travel before, you know, it got from point A to me? How much fossil fuel did it burn? How many trees had to be cut down to make that field of corn or to plant that field of corn or soy or wheat? I want to know all about that. So that's what we're going to learn today. I feel like this is one thing Lierre talks about in her book is that we become, like, so removed from nature that we really don't even understand how it works. And so that's what the show's all about. How does our digestive system work? You know, you'll get all these comparisons of, you know, herbivore versus omnivore or carnivore digestive systems. Kind of flawed. You know, I want to get into that. I feel like people are just reading one article and basing their whole lifestyle, their whole diet, which is incredibly important, on, you know, incomplete information. So hopefully over this next hour, and of course I actually booked an extra half hour just in case, because, you know, I can talk and I ask a lot of questions. But yeah, we're going to get into all of that good stuff. Let me bring Lierre on the show. She is the author of my favorite new book, Vegetarian Myth. Guys, pick up that book. If you're on the Blog Talk channel right now, the book is linked to the show, so click it. Buy it. You will not put it down. Lierre, welcome to the show.
Well, thanks for having me on, and thanks for saying such nice things about my book.
Thanks for writing the book. Really, I mean, this book is like something that I've been kind of waiting for. You know, not to debate people. You know, I am kind of waiting for a vegetarian to kind of give me a lecture so I can have a few comebacks and whatnot, but just, you know, taking the time to research it and also having an open mind. Because for somebody who was a vegetarian like yourself for so long, or a vegan like yourself for so long, it takes a lot of moxie and open-mindedness to actually say, okay, let me actually look into this. So I thank you for that, for sure.
Well, you're welcome. You're welcome.
Tell me, what made you become a vegan?
Well, I became a vegan when I was 16 years old. And I think my first exposure to the idea was a friend of my sister's, and there was another young woman who was also a vegan, She's actually macrobiotic. And we lived in Brookline, Massachusetts, and at that point, the Cushy Institute was centered in Brookline. So there were a lot of, that's the center of sort of macrobiotic world was the Cushy Institute. That was the sort of the main educational, and there was like a little center there where you could learn all about macrobiotics. So it was only a matter of time before, you know, we crossed paths with some of these people. So we were friends with this other woman named Pilar, and then there were a bunch of others that I babysat for because I was just a teenager then. So I was introduced to these ideas about how terrible animal products were for the human body. And I believed them because I also learned in health class, and this was the very beginning of, you know, the sort of low-fat dogma that has ruled our public health institutions now for, you know, over 20 years. And I learned in health class the same message that eating animal products would clog your arteries and give you heart disease and cause diabetes. And when I looked around at my family, I saw a lot of those diseases, and I was already very concerned about it even as a pretty young kid. And so to be told that, you know, the cause of all this was animal products, and to hear this from two different places, it was like, wow, I'm hearing this everywhere. It must be true. And so I went ahead and I did it. I also was somebody, even as a very young child, who was very concerned about environmental issues. So it all made sense because vegans present this idea that if you refrain from eating meat or dairy products or eggs or anything to do with animal foods, that that's a more responsible environmental choice. Now, I won't argue about factory farming because I think we can all agree that's horrible on every level. But they are wrong about animal products in general. I mean, all the statistics and the numbers that they use are only about factory feeding. They have nothing to do with the real diet of animals that are allowed to live their natural lives. And so, I mean, they're wrong on a whole bunch of different levels, but it's not information that's easily come by. So I don't think this is like some big horrible conspiracy. And I always try to say as strongly as I can that the underlying values of the vegetarian ethic are not at issue. That values like compassion and justice and sustainability, those are still the motivating ethic of my life. And those are the only values that are going to get us to the world that we need. That is not the problem. The problem is simply one of information. And this is a really deep cultural ignorance. So, you know, at 16, I didn't know better. So when I heard that eating this way would be better for my body and better for animals and better ultimately for the planet, I took it up. I mean, it's a very idealistic teenager, and I really wanted to fight the good fight. So it seemed like a really easy way to take care of a whole bunch of different problems that, you know, caused me a lot of grief. So I embraced it wholeheartedly at that age, and I did it for 20 years. So that was where it all began.
Totally understandable. How long were you a vegan for, and did it
20
have
years.
Any, 20 years. Did it have any health impacts on you at all?
It had terrible, terrible health impacts. I'm permanently damaged from being a vegan, and that was sort of the second motive I had to write the book was I'm very concerned for other, especially young people who are very idealistic. And this vegan worldview is what you're hearing if you're an environmentalist of any kind. If you're somebody who has compassion for animals, you're told that this is the way, the best thing you can do is to eat a vegan diet. And I know how many young people are getting caught up in this, and I also know where it will end. I'm 45, all of my friends, everybody my age, we all tried it to one extent or another for the same reason. We were told that this was, you know, the most ethical thing we could do. And, you know, 5 years, 10 years, 15 years into it, one by one, everybody gave up. Not because we stopped having those values, but because our health failed. And for some of us, it failed catastrophically. So I was the last holdout in my friendship circle. I would say I was the last one. And in the end, I had to give it up as well. So a lot of the health problems I got, I damaged my thyroid for sure eating the soy. I definitely did a number on my reproductive organs. I developed a permanent degenerative disease in my joints, in my spine. I will always live in pain from that. The exhaustion, the terrible cold, a lot of that just never goes away if you do it for too long. And I would say 20 years is a bit too long. A lot of people I know gave up after 5 years or 6 years or 7 years, and I think that they were smarter. I know at the time it felt really hard for them, and they felt like they were giving up. But I look at it now as, you know, they listened to their bodies. That there was a profound message being sent from, you know, the physical being that they were, that said, this is not working. This is creating damage. There is a reason that they had these tremendous cravings to eat meat or eggs or dairy products, and it's because the human body needs those things. And when you're fighting your biology, it's only a very, very small percentage of people who are going to be able to do it, because you have to be a real fanatic. And I am a fanatic, if nothing else. So I was able to override all those impulses for a long time. And you know, and it also, it wasn't until I stopped doing it and began to eat a more appropriate diet that some of these health problems began to resolve. And it was sort of a moment of horror in that, to think that I had damaged my body to this extent. And nobody had even said this to me ever. Like, did you ever think that these problems might be caused by, you know, because right now the whole, the low carb, you know, high carb, low fat, plant-based diet is the one that everybody's holding up as the way to eat. So it never even occurred. Go ahead.
Even if somebody would have said, Lier, it's your diet, would you have believed them?
It would have been hard to believe them, because when you're in that worldview, it can be very fundamentalist. And you can always retreat to your friends and to books and to the internet, where everybody will, you know, back you up and say, oh, the, you know, the health industry is all against us, and all the doctors are on the wrong side, and, you know, they'll make this big political argument as to why, you know, big money is behind X, Y, and Z. So you can retreat into, like, you know, to the company of like-minded others and have your beliefs reaffirmed. Having said that, the thing that really did change this for me was going to a doctor who eventually said that to me. Now, the doctor that I went to was not a traditional allopathic Western doctor. He was, in fact, a doctor of Chinese medicine. He was somebody that I respected very highly. So when he said this to me, when he said, you know, you're basically killing yourself, you've got to stop doing this, I knew he was right. At that point, I was so exhausted I could barely walk up a flight of stairs. And for him to say that, I could hear it, because I respected him. I had a deep respect for the medical tradition that he came from. And so he had a position of authority, you know, that I trusted. He had earned that. And so when he said that to me, I was able to finally kind of break through my own denial and admit that he was probably right. So that was the day that I stopped being a vegan. But that's what it took for me. So I'm hoping that with writing this book, that, you know, walking people all the different arguments, all the reasons that they think that this is going to be a good thing to do for animals, for the earth, for their bodies, you know, I'm hoping that if I addressed all these issues sort of one by one, because I understand that worldview, but if I, as somebody who was there, if I could address it, that hopefully I could stop other people from doing the same thing to themselves.
Mm-hmm. For listeners out there, Twitter's open, twitter.com/UG Wellness, if you want to go ahead and chime in with a question. We'll be taking phone calls in about 35 minutes or so. We already have a caller on the line from the 206, so you can hang on for a while there. I got everybody's Facebook questions, so we're going to get some of those in toward the end of the interview. I want to start off with a quote. I never pull quotes from books. I had, like, a list of quotes from your books that just made me go, yeah. One of them was, what separates me from vegetarians isn't ethics or commitment, it's information. That one just made me go, yeah, I mean, this is what I'm talking about right here. And another one was the truth, and I really want to dig into this one for the next 20 minutes at least. The truth is that agriculture is the most destructive thing humans have done to the planet. I really want to talk about that one. That section, you broke up the book into different sections. You had, like, moral vegetarians, political vegetarians, and you also had the nutritional vegetarians. The moral vegetarians was a lot about agriculture, and I read the chapter. I got done with it, and I was like, I need to go back and read that again. Because as much as I'm into food and nutrition and whatnot, I'm not very well versed on the actual growing and the whole production and how it's supposed to be done. So I read it again so I can totally understand that, and I want to bring that to the audience as well. I want to establish some definitions, though, first before we do that, because I don't want people to get lost. What does it mean to be sustainable?
Sustainable means that, in terms of population numbers, it would mean that the amount of resources that that population needed would always be available, so that you were consuming or using whatever the resource was at levels that could be reproduced forever. So let's pretend you live by a river and you're harvesting fish. If we take, you know, 20 fish a day, we do not degrade the number of fish in the river, that there will always be more fish. If we take 30 fish a day, you know, we're still not degrading the fish population. But at a certain point, we can take more fish from the river than fish can be reproduced. So eventually, we are, you know, there'll be less fish every year. So next year there'll be fewer, the year after that there'll be fewer. Eventually, that line will hit zero, and there will be no fish. That's unsustainable. So for whatever the resource is, whatever the you know, the item is that we need to consume, and every creature needs to consume. That's not the problem, okay? We all need energy, we all need food, we need warmth, we need shelter. Those are just the things that bodies need to survive, whether it's a bacterial body or a plant body or, you know, a bison body. All bodies need something. But, you know, can we take resources without degrading, you know, the future, you know, the future numbers of whatever those species are? That would be sustainable if we can do that and keep those ecosystems healthy. So I would say that's basically a good definition.
Okay. It's one of those words that kind of thrown around, sustainable agriculture. I don't think most people understand what it means.
Right.
I got a couple more for you. Topsoil, incredibly important. What does it mean?
Yeah, that's the concept of the millennia as far as I'm concerned. Topsoil is essentially the top 6 inches of soil, and it is the most biologically active layer of soil, and it's really the most biologically active ecosystem on the planet. There's just billions and billions and billions of tiny, tiny little creatures that are doing the basic work of life. So plants are the people that can photosynthesize. They take the energy from the sun and they turn it into matter. Nobody else can do that. It's just plants, and that's a miracle. We need to be incredibly grateful to the plant people for doing this. And this is why in so many indigenous cultures there's this concept of plants, trees, whatever kind of plants grow, you know, where people can live. Those plants are seen as our parents or our grandparents. They are sort of our beloved elders. And if you look at the history of the planet, that is in fact true, because first they created the soil that would make the rest of life possible, and they created the atmosphere, this oxygen-rich blanket that coats the earth that made animal life possible. So they spent billions of years doing this, and we are the result of their hard work. So we need to bring them respect in our every action. And what this culture has done, of course, is destroy them. So, and that knowledge that that we do owe them that has also just been eradicated from this culture utterly. And we need to bring that kind of awe and respect to all living creatures, beginning with these little tiny, tiny ones in the soil that we can't see. You know, it's really hard to have a relationship with a creature that's so small that you can't see it, but they are there. So the plants produce the energy, and then they die, and then they have to be degraded. And it's the bacteria and the tiny, you know, the microcosmic little tiny creatures that do that work of degrading. And it means that they make those nutrients available again for the next life, the next form of life to come along that we'll need to eat. We are all in our bodies. When we die, we are all food for somebody else. And this is a great big cycle. I like to say that we're all members of a tribe called Carbon, and we are just taking turns around this great cycle. But the soil is really where it begins and ends for land life. Now, life in the oceans obviously doesn't need soil, but for the rest of us who live on any kind of land, it's the soil that makes it possible, because it's the soil that's doing that basic work of helping the plants. It's the medium that plants grow in. In exchange, it's the plants that hold the soil in place. They create this matrix of roots underneath the very top of the soil, and literally it's a scaffold. Okay, it holds the soil, it protects the soil. All those interactions of plants and microscopic creatures, they create more topsoil. And with the protection of the plants and the work of the plants, and then also the bacteria and whoever, that is what makes this whole cycle possible. Creatures like us, animals, we're really just consumers. We're not really participating anywhere near as fully. And that's why for billions of years there weren't animals. They were really just plants. And there were producers and there were degraders, but there weren't consumers. These other levels came later. That's not to say that we're bad. I mean, animals now have a function. We've been participating together so long that the plants rely on the animals in the same way that animals rely on plants. It's definitely symbiotic relationships. But it really does come down to topsoil. If we didn't have soil, none of this would be possible. And the problem with agriculture, I can see where you want me to go with this. The problem with agriculture destroys.
Before we get, we've destroyed it, right, with agriculture.
Yeah.
I want to establish
right.
One more thing first.
Sure, sure.
Get into like the real nitty-gritty of it, so hopefully the audience can be patient with me here. Perennial grasses, perennial polyculture, that's something I had
right.
to look up on Wikipedia to fully understand that. Tell us a bit about that.
Okay. A perennial polyculture is two words. So perennial, that just means a plant that lives a long time. So usually, you know, at least 2 or 3 years, often, you can find plants that can live thousands of years. So there's all kinds of, you know, either, you know, small trees, or there's, you know, plant creatures that can, I mean, like literally thousands of years. You look in the red. I live in the redwoods now, and you know you've got trees that are 2,000 and 3,000 years old here. Also, you know, like some trees fall, like redwoods can fall, and from the trunk, you know, from the fallen trunk in the forest, you'll have sprouts that shoot up, and so they will eventually grow to mature trees. So the original plant doesn't really die because the root systems feed those sprouts as they're growing. And, you know, 1,000 years later, you'll have, you know, 8 trees in a row making a line. And those are from an original tree that fell. So, you know, it literally thousands of years old, some of these organisms, some of these plants. So you've got, when I say they live a long time, I mean really like just vast amounts of time. They're older than Christianity, some of them. Okay, so that's perennial, long-lived, and then polyculture. Now, poly just means a lot. So polyculture means that a whole bunch of plants live together in a community. And plants do amazing things with each other. They communicate using chemicals. So they don't have ears the way that we do. They don't use sound. But they do use chemicals, and they will send each other really incredible messages through their root systems and also through the air by releasing chemicals. So, for instance, if a deer walks through the forest and brushes up against a shrub, that shrub, you know, will send out immediately into the air chemical messengers to the other plants in the vicinity saying, a moving creature just came by, brushed through one of my branches. You all should know what might be coming. And all the other plants in the vicinity will stiffen as much as they can to get ready in case they are also brushed up against by a moving animal. So they're warning each other. They're communicating. Some plants, when they're sick, will get medicine from nearby plants. So the plants will send them antibacterials to help fend off attacks by predators of some sort, or they'll send them essentially pesticides, you know, to ward off caterpillars or, you know, beetles or whatever it is that's eating the sick plant. They take care of each other. If there's an area that's gone barren for some reason, if there's been a flood or a fire, there are trees that are known as nurse trees because they will be the first trees that come and recolonize the area. And when they're established, they somehow send out messages to the other plants that should grow near them. And they're able to say, come join me. I'm ready. I'm big enough now. I can help you. And then the other plants will come and fill in the understory and make these incredibly diverse communities together. And the plants do that. They're able to organize themselves to make life possible. And the more you read about it, the more just awe-inspiring it is. I mean, I didn't know any of this growing up. Nobody told me. But this is what a lot of indigenous wisdom is about. I mean, there's a tree called an elder tree. That's why they're called elders, is because they perform that role in the community. They will establish somewhere, and they will put out that call to so that other plants will come and help make those perennial polycultures. So perennial polycultures, there's a few kinds on the planet. It's the same template where you've got a whole bunch of different plants living a good long time. But once you understand the pattern, you can see it everywhere. So you've got prairies, lots and lots of different kinds of grasses all living together. You have forests, so it's trees and, you know, understory plants and vines all living together. You have tundras, so that would be like, you know, just around the Arctic Circle, just below that, where it's, you know, a lot of mosses and lichens and stuff. Wetlands, of course, and those very, very rich ecosystems. But again, they're perennial polycultures. And then you have savannas, which are somewhere between grass and forests. It's where there's enough water for there to be real trees, but not a lot, not enough for there to be like a forest. So if you think of, you know, the African savannas, where I live on the coast of California, you can find savannas, the sort of oak savannas on the hilltops there.
So that's your basic
perennial polyculture.
And so everything is kind of codependent. So the grass
very much so. Yes.
The cattle eat the grass. The grass, you know, poop and they pee to bring the nutrients back to the soil. And it's just like a wheel of life. It's not a straight line. It's a wheel. Now, what happens when we replace those perennial grasses and whatnot and put annual grasses there? And the annual grasses being the corn, the soy, the wheat. What happens to these ecosystems, these perennial polycultures, the way it's supposed to work? What happens to those? Where do they go?
Well, here's the problem. In nature, there are also annual plants. So annuals only grow a year, as opposed to the perennials that will grow a long time. Now, annuals have a place. They're the first responders in nature. So let's say you have a natural disaster. There's a flood, there's a fire, there's an earthquake. What will happen is, the ground will be cleared for a while. It will be bared. And that is an emergency for life on Earth, because without soil, there is no life. So the planet responds really quickly. And the first thing that happens is the annuals come into play, and they respond to this emergency. So annuals reproduce by large seed heads. So they produce a large seed. Unlike the perennials that will often reproduce by roots and other sort of slow methods, annuals are fast because they have to be. They're only going to have a small window of opportunity while the disaster lasts. So I like to say that annuals are like the Band-Aid. So if you cut your skin, you put a Band-Aid on it, and that holds your skin together, and then eventually your skin will knit back together, and then you can take the Band-Aid off. So when there's a disaster and the ground is cleared for some reason and the soil is exposed, those annual plants are the Band-Aid, and they immediately, they don't have to compete now against the roots of the perennials. So this is their moment, and they spring to life. The seeds have lain dormant in the soil for sometimes hundreds of years, and this is their moment. So they spring to life, and they will protect and cover that topsoil again. They can't do it very long because they don't live a long time, but they are the Band-Aid, and so they protect the soil while the perennial polyculture slowly moves back in and knits together, just like your skin knits together. They knit together those ecosystems to protect the soil again, and then the annuals die, the perennials take over, and the seeds go dormant until there's the next emergency. So there is a place for annuals in nature, and they do a beautiful job, and we need them very, very much. And that's why they evolved. I mean, the planet is incredibly intelligent that way. She knows what she needs. So you got the annual crops. The problem with the annuals, pretty much the only problem, is that because they have this large seed head, humans figured out that it's almost worth harvesting them sometimes in the wild to eat them a little bit. And the real problem is that those seed heads contain opioids, which is to say they're addictive. So humans started eating them about 10,000 years ago. Agriculture began, and it's interesting to note agriculture only began in six places around the world. All of those places were prone to flood. They were all river valleys. So because there were so many natural disasters on a regular basis, floods, it meant that there were a lot of annual crops that had evolved in those areas. Now, given the wealth of all of those annual crops, a few of them indeed produce these pleasurable sensations in human beings, and we got addicted to them. And that was, I mean, this is a theory that some archaeologists have put forward. It's the only one that makes any sense, because agriculture is really backbreaking labor for piss-poor nutrition. Nobody can understand why humans took it up. This is the only explanation to me that makes sense. It's because it really...
I think you said in the book that hunter-gatherers worked like 17 hours a week and had time to hang out and chill and do their thing, and then it went to this. Go ahead.
Yeah, it's a really easy life, hunter-gathering. Everything's there that you need, and so you just kind of take when you're hungry, and, you know, they spend most of their time doing spiritual rituals and gossiping with each other, and naps are really important in hunter-gatherer cultures. There's a lot of leisure time to do art and to make music and do all the things that we're really here to do. But to go back to your original point, so the annuals, this is the problem with the annuals. Now, we've gotten addicted. Annuals can only grow if the ground is cleared, and that's really the problem. Because they're large seeds and they do not, you know, spread by roots or the other ways that perennials use, the ground has to be cleared in order for them to grow. Now, think about this. If you take, you know, popcorn, for instance, that would be a corn seed, and you go out onto your front lawn and you throw that corn around on the lawn, nothing will happen. They're not going to be able to take root while that grass is there. You know that if you want a garden, you're going to have to dig up that grass. Now, once the land is cleared, you can plant your corn. Now, the problem is that the moment that you clear that land of that protective cover of the perennial polyculture, you're going to degrade the topsoil because now it no longer has those strong root systems in place to hold the soil. And it does not have the protection of the carbonaceous material from the top, so there's no grasses or branches from trees to protect it. I mean, literally, from the sun and the rain and the wind, all of those will erode soil. And that's why soil needs to be protected under a permanent cover. So you clear the land, you plant whatever the annual crop is so it grows, but for most of that time, the soil is going to be bared, and that's the only way to plant them. So this is what's been happening on continent after continent for about 10,000 years now. And the pattern reproduces over and over where you have, you know, agricultural society arises. They use up the resources that are around them, including the soil. Then that power center has to go out into the neighboring countryside and take what it needs. So this is the beginning of imperialism because people do not willingly give up their trees and their land and their water and their minerals. The bloated power center needs to go out and get those things. There's another thing that they need, which is slaves. Because this is such hard labor, for anybody to have leisure time, you've got to have a slave class. So we can look at places like Athens, ancient Athens. This is the hallowed birthplace of modern democracy. Well, the footnote on that is that 90% of the population was slaves. They were enslaved people. And that's why, because this is such hard work to do. We have lost a cultural memory of this because for the last 150 years we've been using fossil fuel instead. We have tractors, we have machines that do the work. As the fossil fuel age, you know, winds down, we are going to remember exactly how much work is involved because it is backbreaking labor. So that's the pattern that was established at the beginning of agriculture. Agricultural societies are always militarized, and that's why, because they have to be imperialistic to keep surviving because they're always destroying their soil. And in the end, they've got to go out and make get colonies. They have to conquer, you know, other lands and bring back the slaves, get the people who are going to do the labor. And then, you know, eventually that land runs out too. And this used to be limited, of course, by how far the supply lines were limited because, you know, they didn't have cars, they didn't have trucks. They only had horses or oxen or, you know, some kind of beast of burden, but they couldn't get very far. So, you know, the amount of time you could walk was about the limit of, you know, how far these imperial nations could go. So it would collapse, and then it would start over again somewhere else. And this is the cycle we've been on for 10,000 years. So, I mean, I have to point out that agriculture has been a disaster. It's been a disaster for the planet. It's been a disaster for human health, and it's certainly been a disaster for human society. We have skinned every single continent. I mean, there are no new lands left to be discovered and conquered. And what that means is we're out of topsoil. I mean, by 1950, we were pretty much out. And what should have happened was, of course, this terrible crash of human population. And what happened instead was the Green Revolution. So having used up the topsoil, scientists figured out how to make fertilizer from fossil fuel. That's what we've been eating ever since, with oil and gas, like literally. That's where the nitrogen comes from now to grow these plants. And this is just a huge ignorance. This is what the vegetarians don't understand.
Mm-hmm. I want to get into the fossil fuels in a few. Getting rid of the perennial grasses in order for the annual crops to grow. We're doing these annual crops pretty much year-round. I believe we call it monocrops. Now, animals fed on those perennial grasses, correct? There were particular animals that lived in that ecosystem. What happens to them when we take up the perennials and start to have nothing but annuals? What happens to those animals?
Well, they die, and they're pushed into extinction. They've got nowhere else to go. They need to live there, and what I say about agriculture is that it's biotic cleansing, because you take a piece of land, you clear every living thing off it, and I mean down to the bacteria, and then you plant it to human use. So all of those thriving biotic communities that should be there are gone. You know, the native prairie has been eradicated. 98% of it is gone, and you could say the same for the old growth forest. You know, 90% of the forests are gone as well, and it's all in the service of agriculture. This is the problem that we are up against that has really not been articulated across the environmental movement, and that was the real reason that I wrote the book.
See, the thing that's hard for me to deal with is not even so hard for me to deal with, that really stands out to me, is that the vegetarians or the vegans are so, you know, don't kill animals. But the actual method of growing the food that vegetarians, you know, espouse actually kills animals. You know, because
yeah, it kills animals, and it kills everything because it devours the entire ecosystem. So nothing can grow there but humans now. Well, there's a few other creatures that can sort of tag along. For instance, mice. I mean, you can't have mice in an agricultural field. So you've got a few little rodents and a few insects, and then, you know, there's this sort of palette of maybe 10 plants. And that whole cohort has basically conquered the earth and shoved everything else to the brink of extinction. I mean, I just have to say that a way of life that is destroying the basis of life itself can never be sustainable. I mean, it is, in fact, insane.
Yeah.
Without a living planet, we're all dead.
Mm-hmm. You talked a lot about, I believe it was two-thirds of the world, it's either too hot or too cold or too dry or something. Let's take, for instance, the places where it's too cold. We'll take a place that isn't properly irrigated. There isn't enough rain. You're trying to grow annual grasses or annual crops in New Mexico or Arizona, right?
Yeah, it's insane.
How do they get watered? How do they get watered?
Mostly they drain the rivers. So all the rivers are destroyed, and they're dammed and they're diverted to these large industrial agricultural operations. And, you know, absolutely ridiculous things are grown in the middle of, you know, semi-desert that should just be left alone. And places that are that hot and dry, it's the topsoil is so fragile. And, you know, it's gone in a generation. It's a really stupid idea.
What about the fish downstream? Were these?
Oh, there aren't. I mean, there aren't even rivers anymore. I mean, the Colorado hasn't reached its delta in over 10 years because there's just no water. It's all been sucked away.
Mm-hmm. And so it all.
I mean, so you could say the same for the Mississippi. It's just been dammed and diverted. And what's at the mouth of the Mississippi now is a tiny little trickle, and a great big dead zone from all the agricultural runoff. So all that fertilizer that runs off of those fields to grow corn and soy and wheat and whatever ends up in the water, kills anything that's left is dead just from that, and then it's swept out to sea on a little, you know, a little trickle of water that actually makes it to the Gulf, and then you've got a dead zone in the Gulf of Mexico that's larger than the state of New Jersey, and that's from the nitrogen fertilizer. The nitrogen is way too, there's way too much nitrogen, and it really interferes with the basic biological processes of you know that aquatic environment. So what happens is you get these creatures that can live with that much nitrogen, so it's algae, but in order, they're reproducing now at such high rates because there's so much fertilizer for them that they suck all the oxygen out of the water. So the only thing that can grow there is this algae, and there's no oxygen for fish or for any other creatures. So they all have to run as far away as they can because literally there's nothing for them to breathe. And what you're left with is just this just huge areas of algae bloom, and then, of course, that population collapses and there's nothing. So we've got these giant dead zones all over the world at, you know, the bottom of these dead rivers that were once the most fertile ecosystems on the planet. And you cannot get more species dense than a wetland. And they've all been destroyed by agriculture.
Oh, that's too bad. What about the salt that's in the water?
Yeah, this is like, another problem. When you start irrigating land, you will eventually create salinization. If you think about your skin on a hot day, the water evaporates off, and what's left is salt. You know how your skin feels sort of sticky and salty after a really hot day. Well, it's the same process for the ground, for the dirt. You know, they irrigate, and then, of course, you know, it evaporates off, and it's also sucking water up from deeper and deeper areas because the plants have to grow further and further to reach water. So it's like this vicious cycle. And so the more water comes up, the more the salinization takes place. And there's just entire regions of the world that have been completely destroyed by salinization from agriculture. So 25% of Pakistan now is basically beyond repair, and that is just growing every day. It's going to take another ice age until that soil is recovered because it's just going to have to be scraped off, and you know, a new mountain's going to have to rise and just start over from scratch. There's just no way around. The level of destruction is just horrifying. And the other thing about this is, of course, they're pumping out these ancient aquifers. So we all have heard of fossil fuel, you know, like gas and oil. But there's another concept, which is fossil water. So there's these gigantic areas underneath the ground that have slowly, slowly filled up with water. I mean, it's just geologic time scale, very slow process. And so with industrial equipment, people are able to drill down into them, just like with a gas or an oil well, and suck out the water. Well, they do regenerate, but very slowly. And the farmers have been using this water up at an extraordinary rate all around the world. The aquifers are basically gone. I mean, they're basically empty, all of them. So that water is never going to come again. And when the last drop of it is removed, that's the end of those crops, because it's the only thing keeping them alive is that water. So we've drawn down all the fossil water as well as the fossil fuel. And the third, you know, the triumvirate here, the third one, of course, is the fossil soil. And that is the concept that I would really like people to think about and to take away with them, is fossil soil. That this, it took thousands of years to create the soil, and in a very, very short time, the human race has just destroyed it. So we've drawn down that resource as well.
Mm-hmm. I think somewhere in your book I read that it takes 4 calories of fossil fuel to grow 1 calorie of food now.
That's unfortunate.
And then we also don't consider, you know, where our food came from. You know, where did it originate at, and just how much fossil fuel did you have to burn to actually get it from point A to point B? You know, from point A to your plate, burning up fossil fuel. It's a trip. I want to talk about a story in your book about your garden.
Okay.
This is so, it was almost cute, you know what I'm saying? Like, I could just picture you just being all frustrated, like, how the hell am I going to do this? You know, sticking to the philosophy that you were, you know, that you had. Can you tell us a bit about what happened when you tried to make a garden?
The slugs, right? The slug story?
Yeah, the slugs.
Yeah, okay. So, I decided I wanted to try to grow my own food, because I knew this was really important in terms of reducing, you know, your fossil fuel footprint. That one of the best things you can do is grow your own food, because then you don't have to ship it in from someplace really far away like California. So, or Mexico, or even China now. I mean, they're, you know, you can get vegetables from China. It's completely insane. So I was like, all right, I'm going to learn to garden. And I was really intrigued by this project because I wanted to be a part of it. I wanted to really experience it and, you know, feel the miracle. So I decided I'm going to learn to do this. So, you know, like anything, there's a learning curve. But eventually the garden, you know, sort of got put into place and I started to grow things. And, you know, the first thing that I realized is that there are plenty of animals that want to eat this garden too. And most of those are called insects. Ants, for instance. You know, you have ant problems. This is a terrible moment for me where I picked up a rock. I tried to move a rock out of the way so I could have a slightly bigger garden bed. And flipping over that rock, well, that was where the ants had a nursery. So I got to watch as, you know, 100 little tiny ants completely freaked out in terror. And every one of the nurses, there's in ant colonies, there are nurse ants, and their whole job is just to take care of baby ants. So every nurse ant grabbed one of the little babies and ran for her life. And it was really horrible because I thought that my life was one that did not depend on death. I thought that I had banished death forever from the equation. And watching the terror of these little tiny creatures, I just thought, this is just a lie. Look at what I've done. And all I meant to do was, you know, increase my garden by like 8 inches. And this was the result, was I had to watch these poor creatures scurry in terror. And I probably killed a few hundred ants that day just by moving a rock.
You also had a hard time with the nitrogen. You need
that was huge.
Soil. I think people don't understand. Maybe we can talk about it now. What do plants eat?
They eat dead animals. That's the problem. And for me, that was a horrifying realization because you want to be an organic gardener, of course. So you keep reading, feed the soil, feed the soil, feed the soil. All right, well, what does the soil want to eat? Well, it wants manure, and it wants urine, and it wants blood meal and bone meal. And I could not face that. I wanted my garden to be pure and death-free, and it didn't matter what I wanted. The plants wanted those things. They needed those things to grow. And to keep the soil healthy, I had to apply those things. And I had no idea how I was going to get it. The blood and bone meal were out of the question. And so what that meant was the only thing left was manure. So I sort of played this sort of moral hide-and-seek in my mind, where, well, I'll try to find somebody who has extra manure, and I'll go get it. But I won't be the person that's responsible for, you know, enslaving those animals. So I did sort of make this compromise, and I got some goat manure. And, of course, the garden exploded into life with, you know, just one application. I could see it was true. What they wanted to eat was something from an animal. So I was sort of left with this realization that I could eat an animal directly, or I could pass an animal through a plant and then eat it. But either way, there were animals involved in this process, that I could not remove animals from the equation, that we had all evolved together for billions of years. And, you know, there was just the demonizing death wasn't going to help, that I had to accept on some level that there was a cycle here that was very ancient and ultimately very spiritual. But it was really hard for me to accept the death part of that equation. Years. It took me years to finally face it. So what I did in the end was I got my own chickens because I thought, well, I can give them good lives. They'll be really great for the land. They will kill the bugs for me so I don't have to deal with this just tremendous trauma having to kill insects, which I didn't like, and I never came. It was really hard for me to come to terms with it. But chickens, that's what they do. I mean, they love to eat bugs. It's just one of their favorite things. So I figured I could get chickens, and they would do the dirty work for me, and they would also provide manure for the garden. So I closed the loop there in terms of having my own farm be a system that was self-sustaining. But it was a bad moment because I had really demonized this idea of domestic animals and using any animal products at all, but there wasn't any way out of it if I was going to grow things.
That was actually one of my next questions about domestication. You have a quote in your book. It says, in the vegan outlook, exploitation begins with domestication. But haven't the animals domesticated us as well? Isn't it a symbiotic relationship we have with the animals?
This is what I believe now. It was not what I believed as a vegan. Michael Pollan wrote a really wonderful book about exactly this subject, about domestication. And it's a wonderful book, and I think, you know, he's got a lot of really great things to say. And it's called The Botany of Desire, and it's all about how four different plants have basically gotten humans to do work for them. So tulips was about beauty, and cannabis was about, you know, pleasure-seeking chemicals. And, you know, he just walks us through how these plants have essentially harnessed humans to do their will by providing something that we wanted. So again, I think that these are symbiotic relationships. Humans are not doing anything different than the rest of the world, the living world. And if you know anything at all, even about the most basic ways that animals and plants interact, you'll see that they affect each other continuously, that these are not one-way flows of domination or power. I mean, for instance, this is just one really small example. There are these fig trees in the rainforest that have their wasps, and each species of tree has a very, very specific species of wasp that goes with it. And those wasps are the only ones that can fertilize those trees. So the trees would die without the wasps. I mean, this is how reproduction happens for that species, is the pollination that the wasps do. But likewise, the wasps have to eat the fruit from the trees, and they also, so they provide these services back and forth. And then it turns out that in some places, 80% of the vertebrates in those areas depend on those fig trees for one kind of food or shelter or another. So the entire ecosystem is made possible by this relationship between the figs and the fig wasps. And, you know, you could say, well, the fig wasps domesticated those trees, or you could look at it the other way and say, look what the trees got the figs to do. You know, for a little cheap sugar, they're willing to do anything for them. But I don't want to look at it in terms of, you know, hierarchy or domination, because these are really cooperative relationships. It's no different at all from what, you know, the relationship between people and dogs, or people and cows, or people and goats. I mean, we are doing exactly the same thing. And in the same way, you know, carnivores change the behavior of the animals they are preying on. And it's, you know, you can call it domestication if you want when humans do it, but all of nature is doing the same thing. We are responding to different pressures. We are helping other species that help us. And all of us are changing all the time underneath those pleasures and those supports. I think we're naive, or we're looking at things in a way that's not going to be helpful if we see it when humans do it, that somehow it's domination, because it's not. It's right. Just what all species do. They have these impacts on each other and they change. Having said that, I do want to be very clear that what is happening to animals in factory farms is horrible.
Yeah.
And there's no way that pigs or chickens or cows signed up for torture. They may
right.
have signed up for an easy life around humans. They did not sign up to be treated in such horrifying ways. And I just want to be really clear that on every level that I agree with the vegetarians and the vegans about factory farming.
Yeah, well, I actually went through a period where I went vegetarian for a while, mm-hmm. and because of that, because of the factory farming,
right.
and
right.
just how cruel it was. And, you know, on that diet, my anxiety came back, my depression came back on the vegetarian diet. I actually found myself back on anxiety meds, and it sucked. And so I had
right.
to find a way. I had to find a way, like,
right.
yo, I need some meat. Meat makes you feel
right.
good. And so I order my meat online now from,
mm-hmm.
You know, a good farm who treats their animals well at U.S. Wellness Meats, grasslandbeef.com, and, you know, I'm getting my delivery tomorrow. So there's ways that you can sidestep that some people just tend not to think about. To the point you were saying before with the symbiosis, we're also dependent on predators as well. I think
mm-hmm.
the example you gave in the book was the deer. When the deer
right.
lose their predator, then they become, the population gets too high and they can no longer sustain themselves, correct?
Absolutely. I mean, this has happened on islands very quickly where there are no predators and the deer get introduced one way or another. And, you know, within a few generations, the place is just nothing but sand because they've eaten it all down to the bottom, you know, just cleared it of all vegetation. And all that's left is a bunch of dead deer carcasses and, you know, the land is permanently degraded. And the same thing is happening slowly throughout the Northeast, where you have these burgeoning deer populations. And there will not be a forest in a generation because there are so many deer that they are eating all the saplings. I mean, they love tender young plants, but there will be no more young trees coming up behind the old ones because the deer have overpopulated. And this is a really, really terrible problem that, you know, we're going to have to face, that
mm-hmm.
I mean, we all want there to be a forest. And without predators, that's what happens. And wolves cannot live in suburbs. Deer can. So what is going to happen? I mean, there's not a lot of great options here. I mean, we've got to completely change the way we live from the bottom to the top. And, I mean, that's, everybody wants to make these compromises somehow so that we can have, you know, cars and suburbs and all our electronic gizmos. But ultimately, those, you know, that's how we're destroying the planet. And we've got to take a good hard look at all of that. But anyway, the deer, and it's a really hard issue for people because deer are really cute. I mean, you know, we've all got the Bambi thing going. How can you not love them? They're so graceful and so lovely to watch. But yet without the action of the predators on the browsers and the grazers, you'll end up with the same desert. So, I mean, here's the thing, like, you know, you've got plants living, so let's say you've got a prairie, and you've got, if that prairie is not grazed by the correct animals, that prairie will also turn into a desert. So the grass actually needs to be eaten. Without the proper animals on it, what will happen is some of the plants will actually outgrow some of the others, eventually create too much shade for the plants beneath them, and then they will be these bare patches that erode and erode and erode until the entire landscape is just denuded. So plants need to be eaten. And then, you know, let's introduce the animals. So now you've got bison, let's say, on the Great Plains. So they're able to keep the grass healthy by sort of leveling the playing field. But again, if nobody eats the bison, what happens is they will overgraze it, you know, eat it down, you know, until there's nothing left, and then they starve as well because there's nothing left to eat. So then you put the wolves into the picture. Okay, so the bison keep the grass healthy, and then the wolves will keep the bison population healthy. And then ultimately, the topsoil eats us all. So all of the, you know, the bison bodies and the wolf bodies will eventually be degraded back into the soil and then will be taken up as new nutrients into the grass. So these are cycles, and it's, we all need to eat as much as we need to be eaten. And that was a hard thing for me to accept.
Yeah, there's going to be death. You know, right. You mentioned in the book somebody wanted to put a divide in the Serengeti to, you know, divide the predators from the prey. You just can't do that. It's a great way to ruin the ecosystem. There's going to be death. In order for there to be life, there is going to be death. That is just the way that it is. We got a question from Twitter, and I wanted to pass it by. I think we already kind of went through this, but if you want to do it briefly, you can. The tweeter says, so either carnivore or vegetarian, aren't we killing all of our ecosystem? Why point fingers? Aren't we all killing the ecosystem? Why point fingers?
I'm not pointing a finger at all. I did not call this the vegetarian lie. I called it the vegetarian myth, and I did that for a specific reason. The environmental movement has taken up a plant-based diet as a way to save the planet, and they're wrong. They're not wrong in their basic values. I mean, I want to repeat that. Justice, compassion, sustainability are the only values that are going to get us to the world that we need. A plant-based diet is not the way to do that, and that's because agriculture is an inherently destructive process. It is, in fact, the most destructive activity that people have done to the planet. Agriculture is carnivorous. What it eats is entire ecosystems. The only hope we have to save this planet is to restore those perennial polycultures. So the grasses, the forests, the wetlands, they have to be restored. And we humans have to learn to take our nourishment from inside those living communities, instead of imposing our food across them. When we do that imposition, we destroy, and what we leave behind us is desert. We've got to stop. The hopeful moment here is that if we took all the agricultural land, essentially east of the Mississippi, and we turned it back into grassland, into the perennial polyculture that it desperately wants to be, the United States would immediately become a net carbon sink. That's how much carbon would be sequestered. And that's with everybody still driving their SUVs from here to hell. If the entire planet did it, if we took all the agricultural land in the world and we let it return to what it needs to be, to either grassland, forest, wetland, it would take 9 to 10 years. We could sequester all of the carbon that has been released since the beginning of the industrial age. We could stop global warming in its tracks. It's not too late for this planet, but we need to understand the real destruction. And that's where the environmental movement has gone wrong. We are not questioning deeply enough. And that is the reason that I wrote this book. It's because we need to understand what has to happen to save this planet. We've been led astray, not for bad reasons, but it's just from lack of information. And that is the reason that I wrote this book, because the people who should care the most do not even understand the problem.
But Lierre, this is what I hear all the time. We're descendants of gorillas. We're supposed to eat an herbivore diet. What's your take?
It's true. There are primates that only eat leaves and fruit, but they have very, very tiny brains, and they tend to live very solitary lives. We are much more like chimpanzees. We're the third chimp. I mean, we are very much more. We're way closer related to chimpanzees who do eat a lot of animal products. We also differ from those chimpanzees in that we have absolutely gigantic brains compared to them. The brain is a really, really resource-intensive organ. For our brains to get this big, what happened was our digestive system shrunk. That's the real difference between us and other chimpanzees. We have way larger brains per body size and way smaller digestive systems. And the reason we made that transition was because we figured out how to eat meat. we figured out how to hunt and scavenge it. And that was the moment when we became human. I mean, literally, we became human by eating meat because it's so nutrient dense. Your brain is almost 70% fat, saturated fat, people. It's a really good thing. You would not be alive without it. And it is what makes us human because it's what makes our brains possible. So that's what happened in the evolutionary, that was the progression. We learned to eat meat. Our brains got bigger. Our guts shrank. And this is the diet that we evolved eating. And this goes back 4 million years into, you know, before we were human. You can find tools that are that old, that are hunting tools. It's very clear that the bones were from the animals. The cut marks show that they, you know, it was killed by a human, and then human tools were used to dismember it, to eat it. The earliest human habitations are, you know, covered with bones, you know, littered with the garbage of the bones. And I would like to point out, too, that our first art project, two things. We drew large animals and we drew large women because that's what gave us life. You've got the pregnant female, and you've got these just amazingly awesome cave art of these animals, the giant herbivores that we were eating. And that was the reverence that we owed to the people who made our lives possible. So we are designed for meat. I mean, really, from our teeth all the way through the other end, it's, there's no question that we are made to be carnivores.
Mm-hmm. Let me throw out a few words at you. I just want to get your take on them as far as nutrition. You can probably tell that I skipped over the political one. I went from moral, then I was like, I really want to read the nutrition part, so I read nutrition, and I was reading the political part. We'll get to that in a few because there's one great quote in there that I think will blow everybody's mind. But let's do nutrition for about 15 minutes, and we'll take a couple calls, and then we'll go back to political. If you don't mind doing some extra time with us, is that cool?
That sounds like a plan. Let's do it.
For sure. Tryptophan. Tell me about it.
Well, you've already experienced this. You said yourself you got a lot of anxiety trying to, you know, eat a meat-free diet. Tryptophan is the precursor to serotonin. So every little molecule of serotonin in your brain was produced from tryptophan. Now, the thing about tryptophan is it's what's called an essential amino acid. And it's called essential because you need it and you cannot make it yourself. The human body cannot produce tryptophan. We can only eat it. There are no good plant sources of tryptophan, none. All plant protein comes wrapped in cellulose. Human beings cannot digest cellulose. So even if you could find, you know, plants that contain some tryptophan, like, say, sunflower seeds, it's not terribly digestible for humans. So you're not going to get very much tryptophan out of it. You could eat piles of it. You just wouldn't get enough. And I experienced this myself. I had tremendous depression for almost 20 years. And, you know, a big part of that was the dietary element. I get email every day, fan mail, from people who have read my book. It's been really wonderful to get these emails. And 80% of them are from people who were recently vegan or vegetarian. And the number one problem that they have is depression and anxiety. And they read my book, and they see themselves reflected, and they start to understand a little bit of the biology behind this. And they're desperate enough to try it. So they go ahead and they eat some animal protein. And they do it every day for a week or two, and they cannot believe the difference. And I have gotten an email that says, literally, you have saved my life, because they come back to life after getting some tryptophan. This is really a no-brainer, and I guess that's a bad pun, but this is not really anything difficult. We need tryptophan. You can only make serotonin out of tryptophan, and you have to eat it. And the really good source of the tryptophan are all animal products, so... I'm really sorry, vegetarians and vegans. I didn't want this to be true either, but it is. We were designed for meat, and you need it to have a happy, stable mood. It's the same for with all your neurotransmitters. Your brain just cannot function without what it was designed for.
Yeah. When I'm doing consultations, my free consultations, I'll ask people, what do you eat? And they'll tell me about it. They'll be like, oh, I eat animals maybe every 3 days or so. And the first question that comes out of my mouth, how long have you been dealing with depression and anxiety? And they go, how did you know?
Yeah.
It's right here in front of me. You just told me by telling me what you ate. And they'll be like, they'll always trip out about that. It makes me look really smart, actually. I like the fact that you talk a lot about Julia Roth in your book. Julia was on my
book. Yes. She's so wonderful. And really, anybody out there who's listening, if you have any kind of depression, addiction, eating disorder in your life or in your family life, read her book. It's called The Mood Cure. And she will walk you through the biochemistry of all of this, but it's not complicated stuff. You need certain neurotransmitters in order to have a happy, stable mood, and you can only get them from eating them. So she has a whole protocol where she certainly, you know, prescribes a protein and fat-rich diet for people, but you know, you can also supplement. If you're somebody who just didn't get great genetics or you've done damage from eating the wrong food for a lot of years, these little quizzes you can take, you can figure out exactly what supplements you should try. I have literally seen this work miracles. Literally, people, you know, 15 minutes after trying her protocol, I can tell what you need. You're going to need some 5-HTP or whatever. And like 15 minutes later, they're smiling for the first time in 5 years. It's absolutely miraculous. This stuff works. And it was same for addiction. She's incredible with alcoholism and other kinds of addictions. So I can't recommend her work highly enough. I think she's just wonderful. I mean, I saw my own history all through her book and a lot of my family history as well. So I can really attest to watching this, to the kind of miracles that can be produced. But really, if you've got depression or anxiety, pick up her book.
For sure. Topic number two for nutrition, grains and phytates. Tell us about that.
Yeah. So a lot of vegetarians think, or they want to believe very strongly, really deeply, that what they're eating is a peaceful, non-death option. And, you know, plants cannot scream, so we don't know that they are fighting back. One of the ways that they fight back is phytates. And so what plants mostly use are chemicals to fight back. So they make themselves poisonous or they make themselves inedible in all kinds of ways. And phytates are one of the things that they use. Now, phytates are chemicals inside seeds of all kinds. That includes grain. Grain is a seed. And phytates will bind with minerals in the human digestive tract. This is to keep them from being digested because they do not want to be eaten. They are the babies. The seed is the whole point of the plant's life, is to reproduce. This is the next generation. And that seed comes wrapped in all kinds of chemical repellents so that animals will not touch them. So, you know, if you manage to get past the teeth and the palate, next up is the phytates in the digestive tract. This is how plants fight back because they do not want to be eaten. So phytates will bind with the minerals. And this means that there's a lot of cultures around the world where you see these tremendous mineral deficiencies because it's a poverty diet and they really have nothing to eat except, say, wheat. And a lot of this is, like in the Middle East, you'll see this where they, end up with these tremendous, terrible diseases from lack of minerals. And it's because the wheat that they're eating is flatbread. So it's not – one way you can disable phytates is by, like, a sourdough process. So if you ferment them a little bit, you can fool the grain into thinking that it's time to sprout. And once it sprouts, the plant itself, the seed itself, will disable the phytates. So sourdough is one way that people figured out how to outsmart the plants. But in a lot of cultures, they never figured it out. So in cultures where they eat things like flatbread, you will see these terrible mineral deficiencies, and people are way too short because they can't get enough minerals into their bodies. And, during pregnancy and early childhood, they're not getting enough minerals. So they're all 5 feet tall rather than being like, a more appropriate human height, which is, most hunter-gatherers are well over 6 feet tall, and that's why. Plenty of minerals, plenty of fat to absorb the minerals. So you get these really great, strong, disease-free bones for your whole life. So that's phytates, and some plants have more than others, but all seeds contain some. And I know this was definitely a factor in how I ended up with a degenerative joint disease was the lack of minerals in the diet from not eating animal products, but then the minerals that I was eating were bound up by the phytates and all that whole wheat and all the whole – I did the right thing. I ate all the whole grains, and that's what I ended up with. So.
Yep. Topic number three. And I want to touch on soy and cholesterol a little bit. We've already had Kayla Daniel on the show. We've had Chris Mack.
Oh, great.
Yeah, I don't want to harp on those too much, but
okay.
B12.
Yeah, B12. This is the real sticking point for the vegans. There are no non-animal sources of B12. And whatever else you want to think or say about my book and my perspective, it doesn't matter. If you're a vegan, please, if you do nothing else, take the B12. There are vegans who have permanently damaged their eyes, their hearing, their central nervous systems from lack of B12. You cannot eat it in any other form. It does not exist. You can only get it from animal products. So, your next best bet is to eat it synthesized. And it's made from yeast, which, frankly, is a living creature. But, if you want to kind of play the moral hide-and-seek and pretend you're not killing something, go ahead. Anyway, B12, you need to get some into your body. You don't need a lot, but you do need some. And without it, you will end up with permanent neurological damage. So please eat the B12.
Mm-hmm. Okay, very cool. Let's do soy and children.
Yeah, very grim subject. Soy is one of the least edible plants for humans. And until recently, we knew that. It used to be that soy was a joke. We knew that, people in prison had to eat it because it was a a cheap way for the government to feed people who were, you know, being oppressed. And then that all changed by marketing, and they were able to kind of repackage soy as an upscale, healthy, green, you know, people who do yoga eat soy. And now soy has spread everywhere. And soy is really not digestible for humans. You've got a number of problems with it, and I'm sure that Kayla Daniels went over this. But, you know, real quickly, you've got, first of all, it's a goitrogen, so it will damage your thyroid. I did this. A lot of people I know did this. Number two is the phytoestrogens. And this is where the thing with the children becomes really scary, because the phytoestrogens will absolutely interfere with the hormone system in human beings and in all mammals. I mean, they, you know, they've done all kinds of feeding experiments on rats and pigs and everything else, and there's just not one animal study that doesn't show really profound effects. So right now, of course, soy is being dumped on to mostly poor children through free lunch programs, and through the WIC program provides free soy formula. If you are an African-American woman, especially in a lot of places, you can only get soy formula for your baby. And this really should be seen as a form of racism, because what soy does to children is really horrifying. Right now there is precocious puberty in almost half of African-American girls in the United States. That is a human rights violation, as a human rights disaster. And
was that before the age of eight? I'm sorry, was that before the age
yes.
of eight?
Absolutely horrifying. Yes, horrifying. No 8-year-old is prepared for puberty. I mean, most 12-year-olds aren't. You know, it's a tough time. And 8-year-olds, there's no way. We're doing a horrifying, horrifying thing to these children. And we've got to understand this. If we're the people who make claims to be, you know, the people who are for justice and the people who want to fight racism, this is it. It's right here. We are destroying these children's lives. It means forever they are going to have hormonal problems that lead, you know, everything from endometriosis to, you know, infertility to, you know, hysterectomies. My sister had to have a hysterectomy because of eating soy. And so this has really affected my own family in a really profound way. But we really need to face what the soy industry has done to us, and especially to the really vulnerable people in our culture. And are they really the only people who have stood up against the soy industry are, you know, Kayla Daniels and Sally Fallon from Weston Price, because they've testified before Congress. But nobody else has taken this up, and we really need to, because this is bad. So do not feed soy to your children. Please do not feed soy to your children. It's taking soy formula for a baby, it's equivalent to having 4 birth control pills a day. That's how large the hormone load is. And it's just, we're not built for this, people. And this is, again, this is how plants fight back. I mean, soy is saying to humans, you eat me, meat, and I'm going to make sure, you eat me, and I'm going to make sure that you cannot reproduce. I'm going to, you know, I'm going to mess up your hormone system so that you're infertile and you, you know, you have all these problems with your reproductive system. It's a really brilliant way for a plant to keep from being eaten. So, you know, the plant has volition. That's what soy figured out. So it's not edible.
It's a darn shame. We got 2 people who are calling in, 206-732. I'm going to limit it to 1 question, just 1 question. Before I get to you guys on calls, I want to do 1 more topic. A couple of people on Facebook asked about this, the China study. What are your thoughts on it?
Yeah, the China study, a lot of people have debunked it because it was really poorly done. And I'll just give you 1 example. They took a whey protein powder isolate, and they fed it to animals. The animals got cancer, and then the author of the study decides, look, animal protein causes cancer. Now let's talk about what these whey protein isolates are. They take a perfectly good food, like milk, and they put it through a really scary industrial process. They spray it onto this, you know, really, really high temperature heating elements. So at temperatures that no food that any animal eats would ever have approached. And we know for a fact that what is produced in the resulting product contains a tremendous load of carcinogens. Okay, this is really a no-brainer. So then they take this industrially produced carcinogen and they feed it to animals. And then the animals get cancer. Well, surprise, surprise. This has nothing to do with actual animal products that we might eat. It bears no relation at all to meat or real milk or eggs.
It's called duh.
Yeah,
you know
I know, and this is kind of like
when you were talking about in your book about the whole cholesterol thing, where they fed it to rabbits. Well,
yeah, right.
Rabbits are—they don't eat meat. I mean, they're herbivores. Duh.
Yeah,
of course.
They're going to get diseases if you feed them meat. I mean, that does not translate to human beings. So I would say it's the same thing. So the China study is rife with these kinds of problems. Where if you dig into it a little bit, you'll see that the science is just terrible here. And so a lot of people have already debunked this, and I would really encourage Christopher Masterjohn is the guy who really has a great article where he just walks you through step by step everything they're trying to study and why these studies were so ridiculous. And I would really encourage you all to read it, because if you're basing the health claims of your diet on the China study, you're going to be horrified by what you read, and it might help you reevaluate what you're doing.
Yeah. Let's go phone lines. Caller from the 206. Thanks for waiting on the line. What's your name? Where are you calling from?
I'm Chris. I'm from Seattle.
What's up, Chris?
So my question is, I see this all the time when I'm at some of our local stores up here, like Whole Foods and stuff, and I'm in line and I've got my raw goat milk and, you know, stuff like that, and I see people all the time up here with their big thing of soy milk and buying all their soy products, and there's part of me that always wants to say, that's bad for you, but do you think that this is a serious enough issue that it would be like a total bad thing to kind of sometimes say, you know what, that just is really not good for you? I mean, especially the other day, there was this guy there with his, like, 7 or 8 year old kid, and this little girl said, Daddy, when are we getting the soy milk?
Oh,
and
God.
I was kind of horrified, but there's this, you know, that conditioned part of me that says, don't say anything, you know. Do you think that there is an appropriate time to actually...
Yeah, and this is a really... I go through this all the time at the store because I see the same thing. I see very, very well-meaning people who clearly love their children, and they've got all the soy milk in the cart. And I don't think it works to walk up to some stranger in the grocery store and proselytize, which is how they're going to, you know, that's how they're going to receive it.
That's been my thought, yeah.
I don't think that it's worth it. But having said that, I think that we need a broader approach to this, which is to get the information out as much as we possibly can. So, for instance, if you're involved in your food co-op, have an evening where you present the information about soy, or see if they'll let you put up brochures, you know, the anti-soy brochure that comes out of the Weston Price Foundation. Will they let you
stop that? Oh, that's a great idea.
You know?
That's a great idea.
But get the information out. So when people are ready for the information, then they can hear it. But, you know, if you just walk up to somebody and say,
yeah,
oh, this is so terrible, there's no way they're going to be able to hear that. Or very, very unlikely. So we've got to have a sort of a broader sort of public relations, you know, strategy of how we're going to get this information to the people who really need it. Because people really want to do right by their children. I think the people who have been most open to the anti-soy message in my life have been people with young children. And they're terrified, you know, when you actually tell them what they've been doing. I'll tell you honestly, I have a stepsister and she had a baby. And the kid was 6 months old. He was on soy formula. He went into shock and almost died from the formula. It was horrible.
Yeah.
It was just absolutely
I look back 10 years in my life ago when I was eating soy, and I had depression and just all the things people describe, and I think it messed up my digestion too. And now I eat animal products and drink raw milk and all that stuff. But maybe I'll do that, make some flyers and put it up in their bulletin board area.
Yeah, I mean, there's all kinds of ways we can do this. Have a community event. Like if your co-op has a meeting room, have an event that's just open to the public. And, you know, you can make a little PowerPoint, or you can get what the Weston Price people, you know, they have PowerPoints you can get. If you really want to get into it, have Kayla Daniels come and do a talk. And there's lots of people who have this information down and do public talks about it. There's probably a Weston Price group in your area, maybe part of it. Somebody there, you know, is good at public speaking. So I think the best way to get information out is in ways that people can absorb it. And if you're a writer, write something for your local paper. You know, you probably have a newsletter at your co-op, and they're usually desperate for articles. It's a great way to start to raise some of these questions. And even if all that happens is one person goes to a website and starts reading, you know, that mother knows other mothers. Mothers are really well connected with each other, you know, and it will start to spread. And I think that's a better tactic than approaching strangers. I mean, I can't stand being approached by people who are into, you know,
I know.
It's horrible.
You want to so badly say something to them because of what you know, but you know it's just going to come across as preachy. So.
Yeah, so I don't think there's any way to do it with strangers. But, you know, broader strokes, we've got to get the message out there. And I think it's really important. I mean, you've seen the damage. You've felt it. You know.
Chris, okay, thanks for calling in, man. Appreciate that.
Okay, bye.
Have a good one. Bye. All right, very good call from Chris. You hung on for a while. Chris also tweeted me. I saw your tweet, Chris. I was going to get to it sooner or later. One more call from the 732. Welcome to UW Radio. What's your name? Where are you calling from?
Hi, my name's Cherie, and I'm from Mahwah, New Jersey.
Hey, Cherie.
And I was a former vegetarian for several years, and the day I stopped being a vegetarian was I don't remember the title of your video, but you had a video about metabolic typing, and
mm-hmm.
it completely blew my mind that there wasn't a one diet fits all, and some people are really meant to eat meat, and something just clicked. So I completely got off the vegetarian wagon. And another reason was because all of my hair was falling out.
My hair
was falling out at an alarming rate. My hair that was growing in looked terrible. And it was just being a woman with all of this hair loss was just the most devastating thing that I ever experienced. And so I started eating eggs. I started eating fish. I started eating chicken and turkey, all, of course, like free-range organic. And I just recently switched to raw milk because I finally moved to an area that I can get it. Of course, I have to illegally go over to New York State because I live in New Jersey and buy it from a farm that's unmarked and bring it back over, but I finally can get raw milk. But my hair just is still, I mean, it's definitely improved, but I still have never come back from it, and it's been several years.
Yeah.
So I was wondering, am I missing out on something by not eating beef or pork or larger animals?
Yeah, you know, beef is really the best. I would say, you know, buffalo would be as good, but we really need to have some larger ruminants if we can get them. There's a lot, what Chinese medicine talks about qi, which is like your vital life force. There's a lot more of it in red meat than there is in white meat. They have a concept called blood deficient, which means you don't have enough red, you know, in your system, enough red blood, enough kind of red qi. And when you're a vegetarian, you become blood deficient. I mean, every time I go to an acupuncturist, that's what they say. It's like, oh, you have blood deficiency. I was like, yeah, well, I was a vegan for 20 years. So I would highly encourage you to get some red meat into your diet. If you can get raw milk, you can definitely grass-fed animals somewhere in your area. Absolutely make sure it's grass-fed. No grain feeding at all. Totally changes.
Oh, of course,
Yeah, you get the grass-fed thing. And the other thing you probably might want to try is you might need some more minerals in your diet still. So broth is really important. Are you making broth every, you know, for yourself or not?
Actually, no, I wasn't even aware that.
Oh, this is going to change your life. So every time you eat a bone, anything with a bone in it, save the bones. I particularly like chicken broth, but it doesn't really matter what kind of bones. You can also get, if you go to a seafood store, they will often sell you fish carcasses for soup. Any kind of bones you can get a hold of. And the farm that is the dairy farm where you're getting your raw milk, they might have, you know, when they do slaughtering, they may have bones left over because a lot of people don't want them. But it's incredibly nutrient-dense food. So get as many bones together as you can. Every time you eat chicken, put the bones in the freezer. And you're going to have to get a great big pot, a stock pot, and fill it up with bones, as many as will fit. Cover it with water, and then you want to simmer it for 24 hours. Don't just give it in an hour or two. You're not after the flavor. You're after the minerals. And after 24 hours, everything good will have leached out, essentially. And now you've got broth. And, you know, you can add onions and carrots and whatever else you want to give it a nice flavor, some savory herbs, but it's really the minerals you're after. So after 24 hours, drain it all out. You'll have this, you know, big gallon of broth. And I drink 2 cups of broth every day, and it really just transforms me every morning. It's wonderful to start the day with. And it also, it's very easy to digest because it has gelatin in it. And people with nail, skin, hair problems, gelatin is really a great precursor to that kind of collagen production that human bodies do. So on every level, broth is great because it's got the gelatin and it's got all the minerals. And I mean, broth is like a standard. Everybody should make broth. And people used to. You know, all around the world, there's all kinds of cuisines where they either eat bones or they eat bone broth, and that's why. So
broth is basically the best food source for gelatin. Does red meat contain it as well at all? Or
the meat itself does not, but it does contain a lot of minerals. And also that qi, you know, that sort of vital energy, which we don't really have a word for in the West, but that is really important. The Chinese medicine, the different organs sort of contain different energies that we all need, but the kidney in particular is where the energy is stored. I mean, they have this concept of sort of stored qi or stored energy. The kidney also controls the hair and the skin. So for a Chinese, if an acupuncturist looked at your situation, this is what they would say. Your kidney is depleted because you have blood deficiency. You did not eat red meat because your kidneys got so, you know, your kidney energy got so depleted, there wasn't enough to go around, and your hair and your skin and your nails what took the blow. So you want to build up that qi energy again, and hopefully, you know, your body will be able to produce more of what you want, which is hair at this point. But the best way to do that is red meat and bone broth for sure. Those are incredibly building foods, just
wow,
biologically. And yeah, that's great. I hope you do it. And a really wonderful book to read is Sally Fallon's book, Nourishing Traditions. She's got great recipes in there.
I'll definitely get on that.
Good, thank you.
That was the question I've been having for so long and have been fighting with, if I should go back to red meat as well. And thank you so much for answering it. And thank you so much, Sean.
Hey, no problem, Sheree. I'm so glad I can help. That's awesome.
Thanks
for calling in. Appreciate it. Bye.
Thanks. Bye.
We got 10 minutes left. It's flying by. Gosh, there's so much stuff to talk about with you. I want to just kind of throw out some of a few quotes from the book, a few things I took from the book, and have you comment on the last quote. I think it'll probably take our full 10 minutes left. One thing I pulled from your book is I hear a lot, 16 pounds of grain to get 1 pound of meat. Well, that's grain-fed meat. It's not supposed to be fed grain in the first place. We're not competing, or we're not supposed to be competing with cattle for food because they're supposed to eat grass. But there's also something else in your book that said it takes anywhere from 250 to 650 gallons of water to grow a pound of rice. Another quote I got from there is, so you're an environmentalist, why are you eating annual crops? I thought that was a really good one. I got to use that one day. Page 107, when vegetarians claim, for instance, that Britain could support a population of 250 million on an all-vegetable diet, they were basing those numbers on the overinflated production only made possible by fertilizer from fossil fuel. And so you can feed everybody with your all-vegetable diet, but you're also going to be depleting the world of fossil fuels, which is a big problem. When fossil fuel runs out, so too will the grain. I thought was a really cool quote. And then lastly, and maybe we'll close out on this one, the surfeit, I think that's how you say that word, of U.S. grain and the starvation in poor countries are not inverse but proportional. Can you explain how that works?
Yes. This is, you did get to the political chapter. in a nutshell, we are told that if we eat this vegetarian or vegan diet, all of this grain will be freed up, and it can then be sent to hungry, starving children somewhere else in the world. And it's a very, very naive understanding of the economic reality that we live with. So we'll start in the United States. There are six large corporations that control essentially the entire food supply, the grain cartels. Because there are only six of them, they essentially have a monopoly, and they can drive the price of grain down so low that it's below the cost of production. So that means that farmers, no matter how much they produce, they can't even break even on their labor and their land and the cost of producing that grain. So what happens is, because these corporations are so powerful and because they have this monopoly, the United States government steps in with our federal tax dollars and pays the difference. So the grain cartels can drive this price down really low. The farmers would, in fact, go out of business every single year, and instead the federal government steps in and gives them a subsidy so that they'll stay in business. That is why there is a surplus of grain. The farmers have to produce more and more and more and more every year because they are never getting a fair price, and it's because of this the monopolies of these six large corporations. You've got, like, Continental, for instance, and Cargill, and, I mean, these are not friendly people. In any other instance, I think the left would recognize that six corporations controlling the entire food supply would not be a good idea. And they are cartels. So that's why there's this huge surplus of grain. Now, the Green Revolution, starting in the 1950s, helped this process along by providing this incredibly dense source of fertilizer from gas and oil, and the nitrogen fertilizers meant that farmers could grow even more grain. And, again, it creates this huge surplus. Given that surplus, and given that the animals were no longer needed on farms to provide manure, the animals, suddenly it made sense to produce them in factory farms. Factory farming did not exist before that, but it took both of those things to make it happen. So now you've got animals living in these hellish conditions, force-fed grain, and the grain is so cheap that it suddenly made sense to feed it to animals to produce meat. It will happen very quickly. They will grow very fast on a grain-based diet, but it will also kill them. Cows can only live about 3 months in a confinement feeding operation because the corn actually destroys all their organs on the inside, one by one. They will drop dead after 90 days because it's not the diet they were meant for. But given capitalism, economic sense doesn't make any moral sense, doesn't make environmental sense, but it does make economic sense. So they started to feed cheap corn to cows because it was a really quick way to make meat really inexpensively. That's the origin of factory farming. So you still have these surpluses of grain, though, because of the fossil fuel introductions and because these poor farmers are having to grow more and more every year. If we were to all stop eating meat, it would not stop the production of all that grain. I mean, they are not producing grain in order to feed it to animals. The vegetarians have this equation backwards. They're producing that much grain because they have to, because the cartels have driven the price down so low. So that's number one. Now let's talk about what's happening in poor countries. So we know this model from the United States. Let's pretend Walmart comes to your town. We know what happens next. They offer things really, really cheap, and it means that the whole local downtown Main Street, one by one, the stores go out of business because everybody starts buying the cheap stuff from Walmart. And we know that it's very predatory, that Walmart does this on purpose, that they've destroyed all kinds of economies, small-town economies across the country. Nobody likes Walmart who is, you know, even vaguely aware of how destructive this practice is. And that's what monopolies are able to do, giant corporations. They can undercut the price, drive the competition out of business, and then they're the only game in town. Well, this is what's happened around the world with food, that these giant grain cartels, having gotten incredibly cheap grain out of America, because it's federally subsidized, you know, just billions of dollars goes into this, they're able to buy it at like half the cost of production. They can go to really poor countries, and it's called agricultural dumping. They sell the grain at a price that no local farmer can compete with. And one by one, the local farmers go out of business. And they have to then migrate to the nearest big city to try to survive. So you've got all this swollen misery of third world cities, and a lot of that misery is caused by this process, by the grain cartels driving local farms out of business. And that is what's creating, you know, massive amounts of starvation. Those local people should have been able to have strong, vibrant local economies and local communities, and it's corporate America that's destroying them. And now along come some very naive but very well-meaning environmentalists and progressives, and they think that somehow sending cheap grain to these countries will solve world hunger. The last place in the world that you want to put cheap American food commodities is near hungry people, because all you are doing is destroying their local economies. In any other instance, we would recognize that this was a colonial arrangement, that destroying those local economies means they are forever dependent on the United States. We understand that this is imperialism, globalization, that these are, you know, just horrendous human rights abuses across the board. But for some reason, when it comes to food, we suddenly think this is the arrangement that we want, and I don't understand it. I mean, all I can think is that the vegetarians have not thought this through. There's no reason that somebody in Cambodia should be dependent on the United States. And if they are dependent, it's so that corporate America can make money off them. It means that if they're not self-sufficient in their own communities, they have to sell the rich countries their resources. So fish, timber, minerals, oil, whatever it is they've got, and they also have to sell their labor really cheaply. So instead of being self-sufficient local farmers, they have to go work in a Nike factory for 10 cents an hour and go blind in the process so that we can have cheap sneakers. That is what imperialism means. That's what it does. You know, it just creates more wealth for the wealthy and cheap consumer goods for, you know, the middle class in the wealthy countries, and, you know, creates essentially a slave class everywhere else of people who are now dependent. And so this is why essentially why the political vegetarians have it wrong. And again, I think this is just from tremendous ignorance, like not understanding the way that power is ruling the world and how these corporations have managed to, you know, pretty well destroy every self-sufficient community that, you know, should be able to feed itself. So being a vegetarian is not going to feed hungry people, and it shouldn't feed hungry people. Those communities should be able to feed themselves. And what they need is for American corporations to leave them the hell alone. They need America out of those countries so that they can go back to being self-sufficient and, you know, have their local vibrant economies and cultures again. I mean, lots of people will say this, farmers across India, across Peru, across wherever. It's like, we know how to feed ourselves. We just want to be left alone so that we can do it. So this is why the political vegetarians really need to understand this issue at a deeper level, because those people need our help. They need us to be in solidarity with them and to fight corporate power at every step of the way. And they definitely need the federal government of the United States to stop giving money to these grain cartels, because that's what's really creating the problem. So, you know, on every level, we've kind of got this equation wrong. My hope is that people can learn. I mean, clearly lots of people care about things like world hunger and justice, but we have to understand the situation if we're going to get the solutions right.
You just blew my mind right there. I felt like I was in that one scene in Good Will Hunting where he was talking about Vietnam and all how everything's all related. Man, you just blew my mind. That was a great answer. We got to close up shop. We got about a minute and a half. Leah, where can we find out more about you and your book?
Oh, you can just go to my website. It's really easy. The only glitch is you have to spell my name right. But it's L-I-E-R-R-E is my first name. It rhymes with Pierre. That'll make it easier. So it's LeahKeith.com, and you'll find my book, you'll find articles, you can all kinds of blog posts about me, my speaking schedule. I love to talk to anybody who wants to talk about it, so you can bring me to your area if you want. I'm also writing a book with two of my friends, Derek Jensen and Eric McBay, about strategy for the environmental movement, and that's really what we need to be talking about, is how we're going to save our planet.
I love it. Thank you. That was one of my favorite shows. I've had some great shows, but that is up there. I don't know where to rank it yet. Well, man, that was good. We got a lot of good feedback through Twitter. People are like, I love this show. This is a great show. You really did a fantastic job. I got to let you go. Thank you so much, Leah. That was great.
Well, thank you for all your work, Sean. You're doing a great thing out here.
Thank you very much. You have a great night. Hopefully, we'll talk soon. Thanks a lot.
Okay, thanks.
That's it, guys. That is our show for the night. Thank you for tuning in. Thank you to all you guys who actually hung out on the phone and listened to the interview. Thanks to all the podcasters out there. Everything's on iTunes. Just look up Underground Wellness. I'm out of here. I'll see you guys next week. I'm going to yoga. Peace.
Geico presents sharing versus oversharing. Today, Bridget Griffin shared a video of her daily yoga routine, two self-help articles, and her new blog called Build Your Inner Bridge with Bridge. Girl, your sharing has turned into oversharing. No worries, Bridge. Geico has some info worth sharing with your 7 blog followers, like how you could save money on your car insurance, update your policy, and report a claim just by visiting geico.com. How's that for building your inner bridge? Bridge, Geico. 15 minutes could save you 15% or more on car insurance.